From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I saw news of a new book called Pressed Plants recently, and it got me thinking about my grandmother and one of the many crafts she enjoyed way back when. Grandma made what she called pressed flower pictures, bits of her garden that she carefully dried, arranged on fabric, and framed under glass, and some of those still hang on my walls. It also got me thinking of the 500-year-old tradition of pressing plants for science and the herbarium world. Whatever the intention, pressed plants are today's topic, so more in a moment, but first this message.
Underwriting support for Away to Garden by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs. Flower bulbs for landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at colorblends.com. Season your spring with Color Blends this fall.
Today's guest is Linda Lipson, author of the book Pressed Plants, Making a Herbarium. Linda presses specimens in the name of science as a curator at the University of British Columbia Herbarium in Vancouver. She's carrying on a method of recording the botanical world this way, as humans have for centuries. She's here today to talk about what information those centuries of pressings hold for us in today's world, and how and why we gardeners might want to give pressing plants a try, whether for art or for science. Hi, Linda. Thanks for making time.
Hi. Thank you so much, Margaret, for inviting me.
We've had fun. We did a New York Times story recently together, a New York Times garden column, about this world of craft and science of pressing plants and what they mean to all of us in different ways. And by the way, I should say, with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com, we'll have a book giveaway of your book, Pressed Plants, Making a Herbarium, which I've just been enjoying so much. It's so practical and also gives all of the reasons behind it and some of the history. So it's really fun.
Oh, thank you. That's great.
Yeah. And so the backstory of my getting in touch with you recently to, to pester you and learn more was that, you know, I have these pictures that my grandmother made 60 or so years ago and on my wall, and I've always known about pressing flowers, as she would call it. And then I know about herbariums because of my work all these years and wonderful places, you know, with all these archives and so forth of history. And I just wanted to learn more. And so I contacted you. So what purposes do herbarium specimens serve? Like, what do you learn from them and so forth? Because it's this old tradition, as I said in the introduction, like 500 years people have been doing this. Yes.
Yes. So herbariums do have a long tradition, and a lot of it originally came from medicinals, right? So this was when the people who were taking care of the communities needed to be able to collect and make extracts for curing different ailments. And when they started to do this, they realized that trying to transfer that information to the next generation or the next student, they would actually talk to them and say, "Oh, well, why don't you go out and go get that plant over there that's got a blue flower and a green, you know, leaf that's kind of shaped like this." And that just really wasn't enough, right? There's too many things with blue flowers and, you know, this kind of shaped leaf. So to be able to make a specimen meant that you could actually really document what this plant really looked like, right? And all of its different stages. So not just in flowering, but also in fruit, because of course, fruit becomes incredibly important for a lot of these medicinals. And so that was actually a really great way in which to start storing this information. And then also what a lot of people don't think about is many of these populations actually have different levels of extract. So even if all these plants are making these different chemicals that could be useful for us, different populations might have different constraints or strains on them because of predators. So they might make more of this extract. And so you actually start to kind of get into populations with that kind of documentation. So it's pretty astounding. It's been around for so long, but now it's just opened up a wealth of information that I don't even think the first person ever even dreamed of, because of course, nowadays in the modern age, we can extract DNA. And so the level of extractions for plants, and now out of a dried specimen, we can extract this DNA. It's giving us more information than ever before.
Yeah. I didn't realize that the original impetus was, you know, medicinal. And so I didn't know that. That's really interesting. And you were just saying that, for instance, you know, different parts of different populations of plants might have more or less, because when herbivorous, so the predators come to go nibble on something, whether it's an insect or an animal or whatever, I mean, the plant has its self-defense that it mounts, and it may make more, as you said. And that's interesting because, well, I just hadn't thought about why, you know, that is one of the issue, the reasons behind.
The thing is I did population genetics, so of course I thought a lot about this. And and being in the collection, seeing the way people collect is always kind of fascinating, the way people collect certain populations and not others. And so, yeah, it's medicinals were the beginning. It was the original doctors, you know.
So do you get calls or emails or whatever from other institutions that say, can we look at your specimen of such and such? Or is there cross, you know, comparison among institutions, because there's all this history and some of these places are just massive. I mean, I've been to the one at New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx and it's like, whoa. I don't know how many zillions of mounted specimens are in that collection, you know, but.
Yeah, I think they've got a couple million in their collection.
Yeah.
Amazing. And we have cross-pollination. So we have tons of cross-pollination. We exchange material all the time. So we have kind of two different systems. We loan to anyone in the world. You just have to be at an institution. So I could even loan a specimen to you if you wanted to go to New York Botanical Garden to examine it because it's a safe environment. I also do exchanges. So we actually collect and we want everybody in the world to kind of see our cool stuff in our environment. And so we'll collect extra species and we'll send them off to different institutions if they want to have examples of what's in our flora so that we can have comparables, right? Because when you don't have that exchange of information, you can get very isolated and you can make mistakes because you're not really looking at the flora around the earth. You're only looking at it in your region. Mm-hmm. And so to have those exchanges going on is incredibly important to keeping the information flow between researchers, but also artists, historians, again, whoever wants to access these collections, they're open.
Exciting. In terms of what we can infer from it, especially in such fast changing times as we're in right now, I mean, you're in British Columbia and I mean, you've been experiencing a lot of drastic, you know, fires and all kinds of things going on. And speaking of things that would change plant populations or their ranges potentially, or who knows what, impact. And I think it's one of the things you're interested in is the shifting ranges of plant populations. Are you comparing to X 100-year-old specimen when you do new collections in some way to say, oh, this is what happened, or there's this new invasive present that wasn't here the last time someone collected here? Is that also done?
Yes. And it's amazing because this is one of the things that I love about herbariums. So they are just time shots of Earth over a long period of time. So they are, they're like the timekeepers of our biodiversity on Earth. And so we are able, depending on how much people collected, we're able to track and how good their notes were. So like I have a great example of John Davidson, who was our founder, and he made a little note about an invasive that's in the Okanagan, which is a quite beautiful ecosystem here. It's actually one of our only deserts in Canada. And he noted that there were three individuals in this area of the Okanagan. We now, because of that note, can map how much spread has happened over the last 120 years because of that note on the specimen, right? So, yeah, I know, right? And then we have things like, we are definitely shifting. We are losing tree line, so more species are going higher up in elevation. We also are having broader extensions. We're also seeing loss of habitat where we know certain plants are not going to be able to make it because their habitats are actually disappearing. We always are going out and collecting and trying to add information. And then on top of that, there's crazy things that are in these collections, like we're noticing flowering time changing. So we know that seasonality is changing and that the plants are responding to that. And then also sizes of things. Things are either getting bigger or they're getting smaller. And we're able to see those fluctuations of morphology over time, which actually, again, can affect the health and the longevity of these plants and other species that we're noticing this with.
Wow. A lot of inferences to be drawn. And, you know, in your book, Press Plants, I read about one example of a type of collecting, I guess, strategy or something called, I think, First Bloom, Last Bloom Records. And it made me, speaking of what you were just saying about, I guess it would be called the phenology or whatever, the timing of what's happening when. I mean, I've been in the same garden 35 or so years. And so I know there have been shifts instinctually, but I don't have the data. Do you know what I mean? In all cases, unless I find old journals or something. And so when I read about that First Bloom, Last Bloom record keeping, tell me about that.
So this is, I love this one. So what a lot of people who I know who start getting into this, what you love, and I think we all love, is first bloom. Because when we see first bloom, we know spring is coming, right? And
yes.
So for me, it's always like, oh, first bloom, first bloom. And for us, it's actually fairy bells. It's a beautiful little shrub here. And I'm always waiting for the fairy bells to come out. So I'm always looking for first bloom. And I love what you said, Margaret, because I think a lot of us who've been gardening for a long time, we have seen these shifts. We feel them in our bones. We see them in our gardens, but yet we haven't documented it. But there have been people who have been documenting this. And so they go out and they look for their first blooms, and we see that shift, whether it's later or earlier. Some species are reacting to the climate change differently. We're also now doing even more detections of, like, even if there's an early frost in February, that can really affect, again, the development that's going to happen later in the spring. And then what I really love is, as we know, so we get really hot now in June and July at this extreme level, sometimes August as well. But we, like in the Pacific Northwest, we're now going to start a cooling period, and a lot of things will rebloom. And I think people forget that there's these reblooms that happen once it cools off and we get water again. And that's a fascinating thing to see how long that will stretch out, and what's the last bloom you see of the season. And that can really give us these, scientists need these extremes so that we can start to do the statistics of when are things really blooming and what are these shifts really happening. And we're seeing it all the time. And it's really lovely when people document these kind of things, either in notebooks. People have floras and they document first bloom, last bloom in there. And over time, they've seen these shifts of the dates, right? To earlier.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the book is kind of a how-to guide to pressing plants. And it also gives, as I said earlier, like kind of some of the why behind it and some of the history. And when we did the Time story together, we also talked to a woman with a craft-based business. She presses things and makes sort of artworks of bridal bouquets and other memorabilia kind of things, sentimental things for people, memory keeping. Lacey Porta is her name, of Framed Florals in Brooklyn. And so, you know, I was thinking about your process in your book and her process and my grandmother's process. You all have a wooden press, and it was always filled with lots of layers of absorbent kinds of paper. But there are some differences as well. So I want to talk a little bit about the sort of the process, the basic process. If people want to give it a try, I mean, what is it that we're trying to do? I mean, grandma just stuck some in an old giant phone book sometimes, but she also did have a wooden press.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like I it's funny. I have a little video I've been making, trying to extend on the book. And one of the things I found is that I only have one press, actually. And that often is in transit to do lots of different things, different collections I'm doing. And I was doing this one press because I wanted to make some cards for a thank you for my book, for my editors. And I didn't have my press with me because it was at work, because I had some other specimens drying. And I take books just like everybody else. So I just put them in with the blotter paper, and I just put my books on top. And that's the best weight you can have. Books always are great. And that's, again, why this is such an accessible science. But the tools are a little different, but what you're really trying to do is just draw that water out. You know, the idea is that the water in the cells is what's going to make your specimen go black or be discolored. So you want to slowly draw it out. You don't want to draw it out too quick. You don't want to cook it in an oven or something like that. You know, people have tried lots of different things, but you really, the blotter paper, paper that's really absorbent, newspaper is not great anymore, but even paper towels are quite absorbent. Mm-hmm. The only problem with paper towels is they can leave a texture, right? Which is what you have to be careful with paper towels, is they leave that extra texture on there. which is why the blotter paper is so nice. But blotter paper is expensive, but you can reuse it over and over and over again. So
and so this is right up against the specimen. And if you have a big, thick press, the other layers can be other things. It's not like you have to have 500 sheets of blotter paper or something. It's just right atop and bottom surrounding the specimen. Yes?
Yes.
Blotter paper. Yes. Yeah.
So
okay.
That's to extract that out. Now, of course, we had talked about before that in the science world, we do use the newsprint. And it's mainly because we're processing a lot of specimens at once. So when we go out, we'll collect about 100 specimens. We need to push those through a system. So we're not only drying them, but we're also having to keep them really well organized. And to do that, we usually shift them through the newsprint so that we can keep track of who's where. So it's a kind of helpful thing. But for the gardener, I do this all the time. I go out, I collect things in my garden. Also, even when I'm collecting plants, you know, you want to use that paper and the press. You need pressure on there. I've talked about cell death. So when you go to put the specimen in and you start to dry it, I usually squish it pretty hard. And then I open it up a couple days later to have a look, and I'll start rearranging. If I feel like I need to see the stamens or the sepals in the middle, I need to remove a petal because it's got this really important design on the inside of the petal that we need to see for taxonomy. And then I close it back up and I just let it dry for about 5 days and I get the specimen I'm looking for. And again, if it doesn't work out, then I make cards, I make bookmarks, I make gifts, you know, like it's the best part. There's no waste in my job, right? It always goes towards something more creative and fun.
Well, you just were speaking to the idea of you might a couple of days later take one more chance before it's really dried to move things around a little bit. And that's one of the differences between you and Lacey, who we talked to at Framed Florals in Brooklyn, because she might take apart a flower because her creative idea for the end product is to use the rearrange the petals, and because the center of the flower, like imagine a rose or a cone flower or a sunflower, is so thick, it's going to dry on a whole different schedule, if at all, and you know it's not going to get flattened and go between glass like she's going to do it. So she may be taking artistic license, which is great. But you're trying to document and show us this record for the centuries ahead of an accurate, and you were just speaking about, you know, for taxonomic, for identification purposes, and, you know, seeing the reproductive parts, seeing anything that's important, all the important parts. And so it's not as pretty, it's as accurate, right?
And it can be really frustrating when you first start. And this is why I really wanted to do the book, because I love the work that these artists do. And I get so jealous that they can pull apart these flowers individually. And like I talked about, like you lay them all out, they're just gorgeous. They dry at the same time, they behave. And then you get to put them all back together like a puzzle. And they can just, you can arrange them so much more lovely than you can in my case, where you really have to keep all the parts attached so that we can see if it's opposite or alternate leafing, if the toothing of the leaves, even the thistles and all the little parts that you don't want to touch. And, you know, even when we press cactus, it's super painful, seriously, but we have to keep all the spines and we can't take those off no matter how much they punch through
right.
The paper and the cardboard, right?
So, right. Like if you have a fruit, I think you told me, you have to like squish it because you have to know how many seeds are inside that fruit, right?
Yeah, we need to know if it's a pit, you know, or
right.
or what the inside looks like. And this is where that parchment paper, that wax paper comes in so that you can, you know, I often do this with raspberries and things like that. I'll have to stick it in there and it doesn't look pretty, but it tells me how many seeds are inside. And taxonomically, that's really important for us.
Mm. So again, Lacey, you know, making her artworks for her clients, she wouldn't be doing that. but so you're using surrounding those juicier, stickier materials like that. You're maybe using wax paper before the blotter paper. You're giving it a chance to stay unstuck and so forth at first. Or like I said, parchment is another possibility.
Yes.
And then in between, I saw that you turned me on to an interesting supplier of everything from presses to glue to who knows what, called Herbarium Supply Company. And the presses are quite inexpensive. They're like sort of two layers of for top and bottom of like lattice wood and a strap with a adjustable, you know, a kind of, I don't know what you call that, but you can tighten it. And they're not very expensive. And then you put like corrugated cardboard and newspaper layers and so forth in between. Is that what basically yeah. all you really need?
Yeah, that's the best part about it. And like I said, we all start off with books and that's completely valid. There's nothing wrong with using a book. But the presses, and this is the difference too. If you notice, a lot of craft people will use the press, and you'll see this in Lacey's picture where it's the screw down type, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's more of a craft type. And that's one that's going to sit somewhere. Whereas I'm moving. So I'm in the field for 10-hour days and I have to be pressing while moving. There's different ways to do this depending on how far out I have to go that day. So I actually have my press and it's portable. And this was always the idea, is that this press is very portable. So we have the early collectors, of course, the really early collectors were going out for, you know, months at a time, still coming back to press, but it had to be movable. You had to be able to strap it onto your horse, right? You had to be able to move it with you at all times. And my press, actually, I have very long, a lot of people use rope. I do use the straps and mm-hmm. they're cloth straps. I'm biased towards cloth straps, but I actually tie it and then I can actually put it on like a backpack so that I can walk around with it and then get to my next spot and then sit down, take all my samples, put them in my press and then keep moving for the day.
Right. A field press. It's a field press. Yeah, definitely. In the last few minutes, I just wanted to, you know, you told me also that you started in this as a volunteer, like 30 years ago, mounting specimens, I think at a community college in Oregon. And is there still an opportunity for lay people like gardeners to engage with a herbarium like where you work? Or I mean,
oh yeah. Oh my gosh.
Tell us about that, because I was surprised. I didn't know.
we run on volunteers. You know, herbariums are notoriously, they are underfunded but it makes us creative. And it also, to me, you just turn on opportunity. And so it means an opportunity for people to come in. So I have a team of volunteers. Every year I do an email out to about 20, 25 people, and they come from all walks of life, people who are retired, people who are students at my university. And we all get together in a room, and it's one of my favorite things. And I kind of talk about this in my book, but it's like a knitting circle, right? So we all sit around and we mount specimens, and mounting specimens is absolutely the most therapeutic thing. So pressing a specimen and processing its data is not always the most therapeutic thing, but mounting it and finalizing it, these students get to sit and read these labels about these beautiful specimens that were collected in remote areas by amazing collectors. And they get to tape them down and glue them down and arrange them in these beautiful manners that I put on my Press Plants Instagram, because I like to show this creative side that you can do at the end. And we all talk about our life. We all talk about our day. We all talk about the podcast we like, or the movie that was really cool, or the class to not take, or, you know, there's a lot of mentorship that happens in that room. And it really allows this closeness to happen, and it allows everybody to slow down for about 2 hours. And that's really what I want to bring across to almost everybody, is one of the reasons I want people to press plants is you slow down. You just slow down, and it's lovely, and it's shareable, and it's easy to access, and it's everywhere. So anybody can contact their local herbarium. There are 3,500 or something like that herbariums in the world. Wow. They're everywhere. You wouldn't even realize it. It's in your backyard. Everywhere there's an herbarium. I started as a volunteer, and it was the best thing I've ever done.
It's so interesting. I mean, because, you know, I would have thought you became a botanist and then that's how you ended up, you know, working in it. But it was quite different. It was quite the other way.
Yeah. I was just taking a class and I saw somebody in a room and I was like, what are you doing? And they're like, we're mounting specimens. And I'm like, what's a specimen? And, you know, it just starts from there. That was my Friday. And it was my favorite day of the week, was Friday for 2 hours mounting specimens.
Well, it's pretty wonderful. And it's been fun to learn more of the history as well. So just really quickly, when's your next sort of field adventure? Where are you going? You going somewhere
Oh,
local
yeah.
or far?
Yeah, going up to we're going up to Squamish tomorrow. It's a beautiful area that a lot of people go to up here near Vancouver. And we were just on iNaturalist. I'm working with an amazing student, Megan Pollock, on rare and endangered species across Canada called Bidens.
Oh,
It's
sure. Biden's,
yeah.
sure.
It's a sunflower. It's quite cute. But we are now detecting on iNaturalist that there's some populations that have never been documented. So we're going to head out and see if we can document some of these sites. Again, taking specimens, pictures, fitness measurements to see how they're doing. And so that's where I'm heading out tomorrow all day is
Okay.
beautiful Squamish to collect a gorgeous Bidens.
Well, I'll be looking on Instagram to see what's next. And thank you, Linda Lipson, for making the time today. And as I said, we'll have a book giveaway of your new book, Pressed Plants, with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com. And I'll talk to you soon again, I hope. Thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Margaret. This has been a blast.
Me too. Thanks. And thanks to all the rest of you. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as at awaytogarden. And happy gardening and maybe pressing some plants meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs. Flower bulbs for landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at colorblends.com. Season your spring with Color Blends this fall.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.